speaking here, of course, of the pre-Reformation church, which we are mainly concerned. We can take it, first of all, in three general stages. The first may be said to be the gospel stage. In other words, how do the gospels speak of the two orders of ministry which became so crucial later on in Reformation times? First of all, there is the class of apostles. The word itself, apostolos, means the person who is sent. So one who is sent is said to be an apostle. It is a general term, therefore, to describe the ones who were sent, much as the name of Christ means the anointed one, and the definite article as being not merely one of the anointed, but the anointed one. So in the case of the apostles, the ones who were sent, who are also more than once described in the Gospels as the 12. So the term apostle as one who is sent of the apostles, those who are sent, and the 12 are rather correlative. And they, we know, are, as it were, universal with Christ's coming. Their names are identified. Their time of being called by Christ is specified. They clearly represent a rank nearest to Christ according to the gospel narrative. Along with the apostles are the disciples, that is the expression disciples is also used, and that is, we know, as we just read in Aquinas, is restricted to those who were not of the 12, but were in addition to those, and their number is given as 72. Now, the Greek word which corresponds to the apostle here, apostolos, is mathetes, which means the learner, the one who is learning. From dicere in Latin, which means to learn. In other words, the distinction was made already in the Gospels between the 12 in the inner circle of Christ and the 72 who were chosen, as we are told, along with besides the 12 apostles. We know these disciples were the regular followers of Christ. They are often spoken of as having been in the company of Christ. Time and again, Christ is said to have spoken to the disciples. And we also know that between the ascension of Christ and the coming of the Holy Spirit on Pentecost, they are numbered among those who were in the upper chamber of Jerusalem. So there is a proximity to Christ which is very definite. They seem to have left kith and kin, at least not to have been tied by ordinary family bonds, and followed Christ. However, there might have been also husbands and wives. We're not too sure of who composed the disciples. Nevertheless, we do know that the disciples were those who were independent, distinct from the apostles. Now, what Aquinas is saying is that the distinction that is current and has been current in Catholicism between the bishop and the priest goes back to this distinction already in the Gospels. But now comes a further complication. As we go into the apostolic age, we find new terms are used. In other words, the apostles and disciples were the immediate followers of Christ. And we now come into a generation of those who were successors, correspondingly, of the apostles and the disciples. Two terms are regularly used. They are called presbyters. Now what I'll do is expand the word. I'll put it here. Presbyters. Which corresponds exactly to our English word priest. I have the Anglo-Saxon, which I went to the trouble of picking up, and it is a P-R-O-A-S-T, at least this form that I found, P-R-O-A-S-T, which was an Anglo-Saxon derivative corresponding to the old presbyter, and this would be priest. So that the English word priest is a direct derivative from the Greek presbyter, and these were often equated and indiscriminately with the episcopoi or the bishops. Now, just to keep the Greek together. Presbyteroi and the episcopoi were used indiscriminately, and here the episcopus corresponds to our English bishop. And as far as we can tell, at least there are enough passages, and I've got a few here, the two that I have, which you can just consult if you want to, are both in the Acts of the Apostles, Acts 11:30 and 20:17. There are many other passages, 11:30 and 20:17, in which the terms priest and bishop, or presbyter and episcopos, are used indiscriminately to describe both those who seem to have been the ordinary clergymen or administrators of the sacraments and preachers of the Word of God, and those who were technically superintendents or bishops. Now, what is the difference in the meaning of these terms? The word presbyter by itself is derived from the Greek for an older person, or just an old person. The positive degree is presbys or presbos. The more Latin, late Greek is ys. The more ancient Greek is us, presbos or presbys. So, an old person, masculine, would be a presbys or presbos. And then, presbyteros would be the comparative of that. So it would be an older person. And we more commonly in English would speak of it as an elder. So the elder itself is a comparative to the positive degree of an old person. Actually, from the very beginning, already in Greek, that is, classic Greek, apart from the Christian language, this person, so was not only an elder in the sense of being chronologically an older person and one who was just simply old, but it meant superior. So that the term used in the apostolic age for that class of person who was called a presbyter, whose name corresponds to our term priest, was one who was somehow a superior to the people over whom he was placed. The word episcopos has pretty much the same meaning. Strictly speaking, the word episcopos means an overseer. Corresponding to epi and scopos, looking over, superintending, overseeing. Now, what's the significance of that? It means, therefore, that as far as we can tell in the apostolic age, the authority, depending on the locality where it was exercised, might have been exercised by one who was called an episcopos or by a presbyter. And while the terminology was often ambivalent in that the one could be called the other and vice versa, nevertheless, already in the apostolic age, we know from the Acts of the Apostles, there was a real difference between those who were technically speaking, bishops, and those who were technically speaking, presbyters. Let's take, for example, in the case of Paul as a bishop, or Timothy or Titus, who are bishops, and whom he told, this is Paul, told them to exercise their authority over the others, including the presbyters, and not, for example, in Timothy's case, that they should not be scandalized at your youth, even though you are young. And this, by the way, is significant, even though the man is young chronologically, since you have the authority, they should respect it. Now, before we leave this, I want to say that the terminology in Protestant ecclesiology, on which the case really rests, as to whether or not there should, first of all, be an episcopal state distinctive from, say, the priestly state or the state of elders, rests on the Acts of the Apostles. In other words, inasmuch as it is said the terms were used ambivalently in the Acts of the Apostles, how can anyone come along and say there is a real distinction so that one is really superior to the other? In other words, that there should be bishops. Is the term ambivalent, or are the terms ambivalent in the Acts of the Apostles? Yes. Nevertheless, factually, in practice, as we read the Acts, we see that there was clearly a relationship of those who were superior to the presbyters, even though betimes one who was a bishop was simply called a presbyter, and conversely, a presbyter might at times be called an episcopos. In other words, the terms as they stand etymologically, or even popularly conceived, don't really tell you what they did, except in general exercising some kind of an authority. A presbyter literally means one who is older, which needn't be chronologically older, but one who is superior, and an episcopos literally is one who oversees. It says nothing, as far as terminology goes, regarding the what we now call the priestly functions, which are distinctly sacrificial. So Catholicism begins. Then when we come to the immediate post-apostolic age, and that means from about 100 AD on, by that time the terms themselves have become fixed to correspond to a reality which had been in existence before, even though the terms were fluid. And uniquely, those who were in highest authority in a given territory were called the episcopoi, and those who were in local authority over a small or relatively small congregation but subject to the episcopoi were regularly called a presbyteri. And significantly, one of the most important documents we have in the first century outside of the scriptures is a letter of Pope St. Clement I, Bishop of Rome, writing around 94-96 AD, in which he does precisely that. He rebukes the presbyteroi for not being subject to the episcopoi. And in 107 AD, we have the earliest extensive documentation on the authority of a bishop. So that we have that famous passage, which I quoted, I forget where, of Ignatius of Antioch, that where the bishop is, there is Christ. Where the bishop is, Darius Christ, suggesting that subjection to the bishop in the year 107 was already considered a mark of authentic Christianity. In fact, Harnack, Adolf Harnack, who, as we know, was quite a liberal, rationalist church historian, one of the finest, by the way, in modern times, but with his own prepossessions, yet a good scholar in his own way, he traces the episcopate, that is, the having of dioceses, structured and territorially organized, following pretty much the pattern of the old Roman Empire, remember we talked about this, following the provinces, to the year 100, and he says, by the year 100, there were over 100 such territorial divisions, over which were the episcopoi, and under whom were the various presbyteroi. The distinction, therefore, as far as terminology goes, clarified with the passage of time. Now, in terms of function. In terms of function, both, more than we can tell historically, both those who are now called technically priests, which is a contraction of the word presbyter, which is a contraction, or rather is just a Greek for the word elder. See what we're saying? That literally the word presbyter is one who is an elder, which is simply the Greek that now has found its way into the English language, contracted into one word, priest. Right? It means it's the same thing, etymologically. But as far as function goes, in both cases, they were believed to have, to be in charge of and have committed to them, not only the preaching of the Word of God, but the administration of the sacraments, and especially of the Eucharist. And we find that in inscriptions, for example, on the catacombs, where those who died, who were in the clerical state, were so identified, P-R-E, or P-R-E-S-B, or P-R, in front of the man's name, or somehow indicated, and then some reference to the Eucharist, which he offered. One value, I think, of examining a thing like this is to point out the fact that behind the words or the terminology, which sometimes can be either ambivalent or even ambiguous, stands a concept which has got to be examined in its own way. In other words, unless we examine exactly what these people did, the terminology itself won't tell us much. Since, of course, in the first century, in the Catholic Church at least, there has always been a real distinction between the bishop and the priest, not immediately on the score of his being, as it were, a priest of a higher order, although he is. There is still a dispute in Catholic theology as to whether, absolutely speaking, under circumstances that, say, the church could judge as an emergency, a priest might not be given the power to consecrate another priest under authority of Rome without a special consecration. And there seem to be at least two documents in the Middle Ages which indicate that in case of an emergency, priests were given the power to consecrate other priests. Even in that case, however, it would, of course, have to be, so Catholics believe, under authorship or under the authority of Rome. But whatever might be said about the degree of priestness, as it were, that a priest or a bishop enjoys, as far as authority is concerned, there's no question. In the Church from the very beginning, territorial distinctions were made following the provincial divisions of the Roman Empire, over which were placed the bishops, under whom were what were then the presbyteroi, what are now the priests. Any questions before that? All right, now we want to take up, I think we have the subject of matrimony. What I thought we would do is briefly, as we have been doing, first recapitulate the history of the sacrament of matrimony, or matrimony first and then as a sacrament, in pre-Reformation thought, in Augustine, Aquinas, and Bellarmine, and then concentrate on one aspect of matrimony, mainly the one which is most controverted and which in which Bellarmine was involved at the time of the Reformation. First of all, Augustine wrote at length about matrimony. He has several masterworks on the subject. One of his best known is the Curtius, that's on matrimony or nuptials, and Concupiscentia and Concupiscence. So on matrimony and concupiscence, that is perhaps his most important work on the subject. Although he speaks of it, of matrimony, therefore, throughout many of his writings. What was Augustine's preoccupation? Augustine, as we know, by definition, was mainly a defender of the faith in his time. And consequently, he was concerned to defend matrimony, first of all, against the Manichaeans, who, as you remember, in holding to there being two ultimate principles, one of good, one of evil, the good corresponding to all things spiritual, the evil corresponding to all things material, he had to defend, and this is of significance for Counter-Reformation thought, he had to defend the sacramental, the sacred character of matrimony on the score of course, of its involving marital relations and the procreation of bodies, which, so the Manichaeans claimed, was something bad. And his argument was very simple. Matter cannot be bad. The body cannot be bad. Bodily relations cannot be bad. Why? And this is where he rested his case. Because matrimony is a sacrament. Remember, he was talking within a Christian context. I want to stress it for just a moment here, because as much as we read and hear about the old Victorian attitude towards matrimony, when you hear the expression, this is a Puritan idea, or talking about those people who look upon everything which has to do with sex or matrimony as bad, their forebears are the Manichaeans. This is where it comes from. And in the last analysis, even certain Puritans who were somewhat confused in their theology on the subject got their ideas, as far as we can trace them, from Manichaeism. Certainly the Albigenses in the early Middle Ages were French Manichaeists. The idea being, therefore, that if you begin with the premise that matter is bad, everything having to do with the body is bad. But there is a much more significant principle that Augustine was after. First of all, he was out to prove that marriage is good and marital relations are good, because otherwise Christ could not have blessed matrimony and raised it to the level of a sacrament. But, especially with the Manichaeans, he was out to prove that pleasure, which for many people, and psychologically for those who have experienced it, is often almost identified with marital pleasure, at least among the strongest physical and psychological pleasures known are those of marriage. And consequently, the issue at stake in Augustine's mind was to defend the laicity, the legitimacy of pleasure. And that pleasure, by the way, always being identified somehow with the body. Joy, technically speaking, the distinction between gaudium and laetitia in Augustine's terminology, the joy was always reserved for the spirit, pleasure as such reserved for the body. In other words, this business of denigrating marriage or of claiming that the body was bad has some very crucial consequences. Because if the body is bad, then bodily pleasures are wicked. And therefore, you might say the purpose of man's existence almost, and the condition of his salvation, is to work mightily against this kind of pleasure, suppress them, and in the degree to which a person is successful in suppressing bodily pleasures, is he living a good Christian life. Now this has important significance in terms of what we've already seen, at least briefly in this class, much more so in the others, or in the other class, the Calvinist notion, certainly the hardcore reformed notion of man's depravity, Now this is superimposing the idea of man's fall on the same idea. It is, if you will, Christianizing Manichaeism. But the same idea was basically held, at least by implication, by those who once you say that man's nature is utterly depraved, and the urge, say the sex urge, the bodily desires and appetites that a person has, once you identify those with concupiscence as original sin, in other words, if the rise of these appetites, if these pleasures are the manifestations of sin, then every time you've got this appetite, every time the desire arises, every such urge is by definition sinful. Now the difference, of course, between, say, the ancient Manichaeans and this idea would be that in one case, you would say, well, your job is to do everything in your power to suppress the desires. In the other case, well, you have. And in the last analysis, if they're not imputed as sins, it is only because of the grace of Christ. Now, much has happened since that hardcore position was there, but we're going to read from the Council of Trent certain passages that point out the crucial situation that arose through this kind of theology. Secondly, Augustine was out to prove the sacramental character of marriage in his controversy with the Donatists, who, as you remember, cut themselves off from the church and administered all the sacraments, including matrimony, independent of the church. In this case, the issue was to safeguard something which centuries later the Catholic Church was so concerned to safeguard, the authority which the church has over matrimony. Because by cutting themselves off from the church, this is the Donatists, they soon began to, you might say, enter into marriage or break up marriage according to their own, I don't say whim and caprice, but at least independent of the church's authority. And Augustine, in his controversy with the Donatists, was out to, first of all, prove that marriage is a sacrament, and that as a sacrament it is something which belongs to the authority of the church, and that therefore, by cutting themselves off from the church's authority, they were exposing themselves to all the vicissitudes of human passion, change, and weakness, where the church no longer protects the sacredness of the marriage bond. In Aquinas' case, he did not write as extensively on matrimony as he did on other subjects, mainly because the whole area of the sacraments, and remember matrimony comes somewhere towards the end of the sacramental system, was never really completed by Aquinas. In other words, Aquinas' theology goes up to and begins with some of the sacraments, but he died before he finished his Summa Theologica. Nevertheless, we have some passages that we're going to quote from Aquinas on matrimony, and again he used the basic philosophical structure of distinguishing between that which, you might say, makes the marriage contract, which is the wills of the contracting parties, and the state into which they enter. And he compared the contract in, say, the marital state to the contract in civil matters. He takes a single brief act of the will for two people, or more for that matter, to enter into a contract. And although it takes only a moment to make the contract, yet if they enter it with full knowledge of its consequences, even in ordinary civil relations, it is recognized that a contract is binding, and that if it wasn't, society would be destroyed. If you couldn't trust a person when you buy a piece of property, when you contract to have something built, when you do anything, society couldn't go on. Finally, Bellarmine. And first, just by way of introduction, and then we will go into the issue itself. Bellarmine's preoccupation with the subject of matrimony was the preoccupation of the Council of Trent. What were some of the changes that were introduced by the Reformation on the subject of matrimony? It's hard to you might say, speak with, well, with complete theological restraint. When you see the changes, the vast changes in Western society that came about through a reassessment, shall we call it, of the concept of marriage that occurred through the 16th century. First, and perhaps most significantly, one of the first things that was done by the reformers was to remove matrimony from the category of one of the sacraments. Both Luther and Calvin at greater length, claimed that matrimony was a purely civil contract, not unlike the kind of a contract that people engage in ordinary civil relations. It may be considered holy, as all secular things are holy. It is certainly not one thing which Christ instituted and above all over which the Church has any jurisdiction. Secondly, as regarding the conditions for marriage, over the centuries the Church had felt itself authorized to lay down the conditions on which persons could be married, called impediments which had to be removed, or at least conditions which had to be fulfilled. It was stated by the reformers, all the impediments set up by the Church over the centuries were a usurpation. And realizing soon that there had to be some kind of an authority over marriage, the authority was put into the hands of the state. Thirdly, under the Reformation, and already in Luther's time, more so than with Calvin refers to it, he never made an issue of it, and given his rather rigorous or rigid morality or moralism, you wouldn't expect him to be much preoccupied with this. Luther was. The question of stability in marriage. Luther, in his own lifetime, publicly and in writing, and the documents are incontrovertible, allowed remarriage between Christians after having been married and lived as husband and wife. Now, what I want to do is to read, as we go on, certain sections in the In Aquinas and in Bellarmine, as we go down the teaching of, you might say, pre-Reformation Christianity on the subject of marriage. We'll try to follow a logical sequence and read from these sources as needed. First of all, in the eyes of the pre-Reformation Church, there was no question but that marriage is a sacrament. Augustine, who didn't have really to prove it because pretty much it was admitted, yet had to point out its sacred character, especially against the Manichaeans, refer to the fact that already from the time of St. Paul, marriage was compared to the relationship of Christ and his Church, and that regularly it was believed that there were three partners to the marriage contract. And this is Augustine. It was the husband, wife, and Christ. Augustine also points out that in the sacramental character of marriage, since you must have a sacrament, there must be some kind of an outward sign or symbol, and then a corresponding internal invisible grace. The outward external sign was their mutual acceptance of each other for husband and wife, or put in the other way, their mutual giving of their bodies to each other with exclusive rights for purposes of procreation out of mutual love and satisfaction. Augustine, and surprisingly, given his preoccupation with grace, goes out of his way to point out how consequential is a single act of the human will, in this case mutually exchanged, that all they've got to do is mean what they say, accept each other, and from that moment on, their mutual exchange of wills brings, so he said, the grace of Christ into their union. Augustine was the one who first distinguished the twofold purpose or end of marriage. So marriage has its purpose primarily for the procreation of children and their nurture. And he stressed the second part more than perhaps we do in modern times. And as a matter of fact, in ecumenical relations, especially say in speaking on the subject of marriage before Protestant or non-Catholic groups, I point out that in the early church, and Augustine would be a good example, while the idea of procreating children, of beginning them physically, was never, of course, omitted from the primary end, the stress was always on the fact that the children need father and mother, see, to be brought up. And that consequently, the institution of marriage has in its purpose not only what may really be ridiculed, as is often, at least, may be ridiculed. The Catholicism holds that marriage, the primary purpose of marriage, is to produce children. Well, obviously, you don't have to be married to have a child. And Augustine, especially that idea of the training, the nurture, the education, that a child needs father and mother united between themselves so that the child learns to love from the love between father and mother, and the stability, whatever else the child needs, it needs a sense of security. Parents must care and the child must love. The primary end of marriage, therefore, according to Augustine, is procreation indeed, but especially a stress on the need for a stable union to give the child security and love. The secondary, so, children in general. And as he said, uses the word prolems. And this, by the way, is probably a better way of looking at it. The primary purpose of marriage is children, whatever has to do with them. And not only, or even you might say, so importantly, the biological procreation. That bears stress and emphasis. And if there is anything, as a matter of fact, that being statistically proved, the devastating effect of toying with the stability of marriage is the consequences that befall the children. Now, Augustine saw only some of that among the Donatists, who began to play loose with a marriage bond once they had torn themselves away from the church and were under their own authority and away from the authority of the church. But secondly, and importantly, there is a stress which is sometimes believed to be too strong. The sex drive, Augustine stresses very much as a source, in other words, of control, or better, of regulation of the sex drive, so that the sex appetite, which is God-given and which Augustine defended time and again against the Manichaeans, who claim that everything bodily, and here certainly the bodily pleasure of sex, is wrong, while defending that, he did stress, and some would believe, at times overstressed, the importance of marriage as a means whereby the sex appetite may be controlled. In the process of his insistence on marriage as a means of controlling the sex appetite, he delivered himself at times of statements that have been used and abused over and over again. As though, in other words, as though, which has to be taken out of context to have it look like that, the purpose of marriage was to keep out of sin. Now, Augustine particularly is one who is used in these quotations against the high idealism of Christian marriage. Now, what he was doing, and especially with the Pelagians, was to point out how imperious this appetite is, that if a person isn't married and his vocation is to marry, he's going to have one tough time remaining chaste, as he could point to himself, a good example. But in stressing the strongness of this appetite, how difficult it was to remain chaste, and you might say, what a blessing. You might almost say sometimes, Brother Augustine, what a break, that there was a state in which this appetite could be used and enjoyed without sin. This has been more than once, as I say, abused against the high idealism of marriage, as though he was saying this is the main purpose. He wasn't. Secondly, in terms of mutual love, some of the most beautiful passages in Augustine occur in his using marriage as a symbol, time and again. You have them, for example, in your selections, as a symbol of the love between Christ and his church. And in using a man like Augustine, who has often been quoted against both the Catholic and the Protestant positions, we must recognize, first of all, the context in which he was writing, but also be sure to find those stresses or emphases, as here, for example, the role of marriage to foster the mutual love, to show how, just as Christ's love for his church is absolutely selfless, he loves with looking by looking for nothing in return, so the husband should love his wife, and correspondingly, just as the church or Christians ought to love Christ selflessly, so the wife as the spouse ought to love her husband. We'll take a 10-minute break, and we'll have something on the board, I think, to help follow the directives. So, as you would expect, the first thing he would ask is, well, not some broad existential subject, but what is the cause of, what are the causes of things? What's the causality of marriage? Now, it's at this point that he raises an issue that the church over the centuries has always made a great deal of. He says the causality, and this is of some consequence, that which causes the marriage is the mutual consent of the two people. Now, the more elaborate the ceremony and the more things seem to happen, the more suspicious a person is that, well, what really caused the marriage is the two people who decided to marry. It's their will, somehow externally manifest. Now, behind it stands something that Aquinas dwells on at some length, although he doesn't go into all of the premises. On the assumption that there is a marriage only insofar as there is mutual consent. And notice the word is mutual. Insofar as there is mutual consent, we have a valid contract. Anything which either, you might say, militates against or questions the mutuality of the consent, or in especially, and the word consent is deliberate on the part of Aquinas, it must be a full, deliberate, wide awake awareness of what a person is getting into. I don't want to stress this too much, but a perfect awareness of the consequences of one's act of the will that forms a consent. So there are all kinds of words that Aquinas could have used for an act of the will. He used the one which expresses most complete deliberation. Now there are two elements that make for consent. And the consent is truly consent, complete agreement, where you have full knowledge and complete freedom. John, would you like to close the door? Now others have come along and have used the premises of Aquinas and developed them along moral theology lines, which Aquinas never did. But given the essence of the conflict, now this is, I'd say, even as I know in teaching priests who handle this stuff professionally, to realize that the essence, see, of the contract is that consent. It's in there. And therefore, as much as the more they know about what this thing is all about, right? I don't say the more valid the contract will be, because the amount of knowledge that has to be had is rather minimal, and most people have it. But that given the fact that the consent depends upon knowledge, the deeper the knowledge, the vaster, the clearer, the better the consent, and the more, and this is something that Aquinas points out, inasmuch as God respects the human agents. See, this is one sacrament where the will, see, is crucial. Inasmuch as God respects the human agents, while he will give grace, he gives his grace, other things being equal, according to the human agent. Right? In other words, there's such a thing as tempting providence. And while marriage is a sacrament indeed, and God will give his grace, he'll do that. You just open the floodgates, and God will pour in the grace. But the amount of grace, the kind of grace, and so on, is to be measured according to God's own plan, according to a person's awareness of what he is getting into, and consequently, if people rush into marriage, it is valid, all right. But inasmuch as the essence of the marriage on the human side is the consent, there is such a thing as making greater demands upon God's grace. And as a consequence, even with the grace, things become more difficult if there is not enough of this prior knowledge. And the same with freedom. Now the freedom element is the one that has been used time and again. We'll see that we handle the subject of the Council of Trent in Belgium on the subject of a valid contract. It is here particularly that if there is not complete freedom on both sides, if there is sufficient duress to militate against true freedom, the contract is at least suspect and may even be invalid. And in teaching, as I do the parsing in morals and merits to the classes during the year, I point out the importance of not doing anything that could throw suspicion on your being a free agent where you marry. Above all, I plead with them in God's name. See? Do be free to marry so that there is not a child on the way, that this is one reason why you marry. For the rest of their lives, and I just have dealt with too many married people, for the rest of their lives, there is always at least a suspicion. And that can be thrown up, and as a matter of fact, the Catholic Church, as you know, even recognizes that as nullifying the contract, provided it can be proved. At any rate, the element of freedom, complete freedom in marrying, and in marrying not just in general, they may want to marry all right, but to marry this person. That's the kind of freedom there must be. But I want to just isolate this for a few minutes to point out that an Aquinas' teaching is the teaching of pre-Reformation thought and still the teaching of Catholicism on the theology of marriage. The essence of the marriage on the human side is the act of the will. See? That's it. And as a consequence, the more knowledge and freedom, of course, the couple bring to that contract, the more they can, humanly speaking, expect God's blessings. See? When you see youngsters marrying, sometimes, as you know, even finished high school, one of my students told me she works at one of the stores in town, and she told me this past spring, a girl customer came there for maternity clothes. She was 12 years old, in her 13th year. In the course of conversation, it turned out that the boy she was marrying was 14. Mm-hmm. It is. And it's tragic because...
Well, why would anybody let them get married?
Well, that's the question. That's our society. Yes.
One thing relative to that, here in Kalamazoo, as you're probably very well aware of, there is a proposal that's going to be on the ballot this fall on liquor by the glass in the county saloon. And I, for one, am particularly opposed to this, and this is one of the reasons I am opposed to it. Because of the influence of alcohol, these things have come about.
The dog and cats.
That's correct. Right. But yet I find the, at least I haven't seen anything active on the part of Catholicism
to do what, Lynn?
To try to exert themselves and to influence their parishioners or to influence the public at large to be against this proposal. Or maybe they're going to. I mean, maybe
well,
I'm not.
Are, I don't
I'm
know
judging poorly here. Maybe you
well,
can enlighten
Kalamazoo,
me here.
Well, Kalamazoo is not. You might say any kind of a majority Catholic town. See.
Oh, I realize that.
Yeah, I mean, just, it's not. They're not. You might see enough Catholics to go around to make that kind of an impact.
Father, I have two questions. First,
Kalamazoo
is does the Catholic Church, or could the Catholic Church, in all justice, come out with a statement to its people or make a stand to parishioners, in as much as it's a civil matter, insofar as it involves voting?
Well,
in other words, to me, it seems almost as though to take a stand on it would be to say vote for such and such or against such and such.
Well, no, I don't think the Church, I don't think it should make it, you might say, that specific. On the other hand, I think what Lenin is probably opting for is, well, preaching, teaching, and propagandizing, right? On the evils of, say, drinking among young people and the consequence tragedy that can enter their lives.
I mean, well, people under the influence of alcohol
well, things I would say,
that they
gosh,
would not normally do.
Again, I would admit that Catholicism has not been outstanding. That's a safe statement, see? In advocating, well, either teetotalism or being in favor of prohibition. Now, that is a very safe statement. But along with that, they do preach and they teach. And in my own classes, for example, I have a whole chapter on drinking and alcoholism in my course on morals. I suppose where there hasn't been the same insistence, it might be part of the ecumenical problem, Len. Too often, I think Catholics might think, well, if somebody is against liquor, he must be a Protestant. I'm honest. See? He must be a Protestant. And, who are we to, to, you might say, go along with it? So I think it would be this kind of interchange of ideas, okay, which can be done. I think it should be. I'd say you're right, and I think Catholicism or Catholics could do more along that line.
So here's a very practical application of ecumenicalism right here in Kalamazoo.
It sure
can
is.
Be used.
To hear a sermon on a Sunday morning, on the evils of drink. I think it would be, people might ask themselves, are they in the First Baptist Church or are they in St. Augustine? But I'd say yes. It should be done. Mike.
I don't like to speak for the Catholic community, but I think most of the people I know are for this one.
They're for it.
For removing it, because I mean, Kalamazoo is kind of a, as far as liquor goes, it's kind of a weird place and compared to the rest of the state. And I don't think, what's set up here.
That in good Catholic theology, the cause of marriage is the mutual consent to human wills. That's the cause of the marriage. It means, therefore, that everything else, and there are many things that are peripheral to the marriage contract, there are ceremonies, there is the Mass, for example, for a Catholic, there are all kinds of blessings and whatnot. That is not what causes the marriage. The cause of the marriage is the will. In fact, it is a unique sacrament in this respect. Those two wills exchanging, see, their mutual rights, are what make the contract. There's nothing like it. Nothing like it. Now the blessings, the triad is familiar. It's Augustine's triad. The three blessings of marriage are children, whom God gives the couple to rear. And notice, I don't know where we pick this biological idea, but the purpose of marriage is to produce children. It's mean, it's to rear children, it's to train them, to prepare them, to nurture them. See, it's not just putting them into the world. Here, they're, it's born. No. So children with all the, with all that makes a child, not just that makes a human being that has come out of the womb. Secondly, faithful love. In other words, the fostering of mutual love. One of the great blessings. And Aquinas, with all of his metaphysics, see, waxes poetical when he deals with this idea that the human heart craves, wants, someone that it can really love. See? And someone that it can love and love until death. See? It satisfies the craving, as Aquinas says, for passion. And this is not often recognized. See? One of the great blessings of marriage is that it assures one of a friend, one in the deepest sense of the word, with whom we can share our lives until death, love and be loved. See? The satisfying, first of all, therefore, of giving oneself to something outside of oneself, with his children, the instinct to love and be loved, which is satisfied in having a spouse, even though there shouldn't be children, and thirdly, grace of God. Now this grace, this blessing of God, affects not only, of course, the immediate purpose of, say, with children, or the fostering of their mutual love. Too often that is thought about. Now that's true. God's grace is given to the couple, see, to rear their children, to know when to bawl them out and when to praise them, and how to help them, and so on. A mother, talking to me the other day, has a girl in her late teens, who's getting out of hand, doesn't know what to do. The mother has a car, she doesn't want to have the daughter use the car, and the daughter is getting rambunctious. So I said, well, now, lady, I didn't call her lady. Have you thought of bargaining with your daughter? What do you mean? Well, now she does certain, for example, she never cleans up her room. She hasn't washed a dish, she said, in 2 years. Not further, don't know. Have you thought of using some sanctions? Well, she's a grown girl. Sure she is, but she's still a child. Really, in many ways she's a child. Consequently, use sanctions, rewards and punishments. Now she likes a car. Good, use that as a reward. Well, I told her this about a week ago. She talked to me the other day and she says, it's working. She cleaned her room for the first time in 2 years. And the price was to get the car that night. See? Anyhow. The humanism, such as it is. But it's not only that which God which God gives the parents to know what to do in a critical situation. But grace for the people themselves to help them sanctify and save themselves. See? In other words, marriage ensures blessings from God in virtue of the sacrament that the married, unmarried people don't get. They may get other graces, but they don't get those kinds of graces. And then the ox opera operato, in other words, by the very fact they've entered the contract, they have a guarantee from God of those blessings. And they continue until death, until the death of one of the spouses. In fact, as I tell them, especially with widowed people, this is something which is comforting for them to know. They are promised grace even after the death of their partner. Because sometimes the greatest cross they've got to bear, see, in marriage or in their married life, is the loss of a husband or wife. See? And God gives them the strength even to bear that. In fact, that's part of the blessing that God ensures. Or not, which is, of course, marriage government, as we said, the issue is one of coming into contact and conflict with a whole theology whose changes in doctrine, according to Catholic standards, were monumental. I say this with perfect simplicity and with, I think, historical accuracy. Those changes, those differences, have not been more consequential in any other field than in the field of marriage. Now that's saying a lot, because you take the whole field of justification, of grace, of the nature of the church, of the whole sacramental system, great big cosmic differences that have since, the two, four centuries, separated the two forms of Christianity. I do not believe there is a single one which has been more consequential with more drastic effects on Western society than the teaching of the Reformation on marriage and the Counter-Reformation's counter-teaching on the same subject. We'll take up about, well, as much as we can handle, 6-7 areas that Bellarmine will explore in his treatise on matrimony, is one of the longest in his controversial writings. The areas that he followed were conditioned pretty much by the Reformers' writings themselves. They wrote extensively on marriage. They wrote polemically. They wrote theologically. And they influenced their contemporaries. The Council of Trent then, in a long series of sessions, spent several years, by the way, you know, several years meeting, when you think of the Second Vatican in its third session, we may have a long, long Second Council. As you know, bishops are dying right and left. And what I mean is... Bishops are dying, now Bishop Helen of Atlanta. The heat and the food or lack of it, and I've been in Rome. You know, they say, pardon me for the preface. There are two conditions, I was told, for surviving in Rome. A cast iron stomach and a sense of humor. And if you like either, you've got great difficulties. You've got to take a lot of things, which the Romans do with a grain of salt, and you've got to be able to withstand everything. Because they just don't live in the antiseptic atmosphere of the beetle. You see, we've been so immunized that no respectable germ comes near us because we've got inoculations and vaccines against everything. But, so the prelates are, and the other council is going on. You don't know how long it's going to go on. They go on for years. They spent up to 3 years on the subject of marriage in the Council of Trent. So Bellarmine followed the sequence of both Reformers and Trent. What are the areas that he covered?
The first was to defend marriage as a sacrament,
and therefore as something instituted by Christ and not as an innovation of the church. And as you see immediately, he was writing in the late 16th century, which meant 75 to 80 years after the first wave of polemic writings of Luther and Calvin, who charged universally, this is a thesis in all the great reformers. Marriage is an ecclesiastical innovation as a sacrament. Well, marriage is not an ecclesiastical innovation. Oh, no. But marriage is a sacrament. It is something which the church brought in. And why? Calvin is very outspoken. You've got to read it to believe it. The reason why Catholicism or the Catholic Church made marriage a sacrament was to control human lives. To control the lives of its members. Because, as he correctly said, anyone who controls marriage controls society. That's true. That's true. And just to insert one small parenthesis, this is the real issue in church and state relations. There are 100 others. This is the 101st.